Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument is Jason Dodson, appellant versus the South Dakota Department of Human Services. And appellees, for the appellant, we have Mr. Edward Carpenter, who's an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Gary Timpson, attorney from Sioux Falls. The court would note that Justice Sabers is disqualified in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Arthur Rush, presiding judge of the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Mr. Carpenter, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ed Carpenter. I live and practice law in Rapid City, South Dakota. I'm here representing Jason Dodson, a special administrator of the estate of Christy M. Dodson, deceased. We're here this morning on the Wednesday before Easter. 21-year-old Christy was discharged from HSC on Wednesday morning before Easter 2001, 4 years ago. At the time of her discharge, she had only been at HSC for 8 days, counting part days and weekend, even though she had been transferred for long-term care, which was to take 3 to 4 weeks, if not 2 months, for her medication to stabilize and her condition. She was released on an inadequate dosage of Zyprexa that for a period of time, at least 2 or 3 weeks beyond the date of her release, would have, based on studies, no more impact than a placebo. She was allegedly, she was unstable at the time of her release. She had been cycling in her bipolar condition. She was allegedly being discharged against medical advice, although Dr. Alsgaard ignored and totally failed to follow the discharge procedures which were required by South Dakota statute as implemented by HSC policies. Neither Christie's family nor Capital Area Counseling, where Christie's outpatient care was to be transferred, were made aware that her diagnosis was bipolar disorder, nor were they told that Dr. Alsgaard believed that Christie should continue to be hospitalized for further care on an inpatient basis because of his concern that she would not remain stable on her medications and his concern regarding her overall stability on release. Nor was Christie's family told what signs or symptoms to look for, even though the American Psychiatric Guidelines for Treatment of Bipolar make it clear that bipolar patients don't have the ability to recognize until it's too late, they're too far down the road, the symptoms and the signs and what's happening to them, and that the enlistment and education of the family is a critical part of the care. Now, based on the evidence, the jury found by special interrogatory that Dr. Alsgaard breached the applicable standard of care and that his negligence was a legal cause of Christie's death by suicide. This jury finding is not challenged by the defendant and stands here undisputed before this court. The jury, however, also determined that Christie was contributorily negligent as to bar any recovery based on the court's instruction that in spite of her mental illness and absence of any expert testimony by the defense to establish her ability to control her actions at the time of the suicide, that her conduct was to be judged against the standard of a reasonable and prudent person. It is the trial court's decision to instruct the jury on the defenses of contributory negligence and assumption of the risk, and the failure of the trial court to grant plaintiff's motion for a directed verdict on the issues raised by the defenses that are being challenged as reversible error in this appeal.
Did the defense during the trial challenge her medical diagnosis, or did they accept it?
The bipolar diagnosis is Dr. Alsgaard and HSC's diagnosis.
Right.
Before proceeding forward, I think I submit that it's important to just have a couple of other facts that I think are significant in mind. Bipolar disorder is a biological condition of unknown cause. It's not self-induced. There is no history or allegation of alcohol or drug abuse or any other conduct on the part of Christy Dodson leading to her mental illness. Christy led a normal, full life up until she became ill in the fall of 2000. Christy had a loving, supporting husband and a loving, supportive family who did and would do anything for her, as well as many, many friends from all walks of life. The evidence presented was that if properly treated, in all probability, Christy would have fully recovered and with proper follow-up care, led a normal, full life. There is no evidence that after discharge from HSC, Christy failed to take her proper medication, her prescribed medications, or failed to follow any instructions given by HSC. The finding of contributory negligence is without a doubt based on the act of the suicide itself. Plaintiff respectfully submits that when a particular act or condition, such as suicide, is foreseeable, if an individual is negligently treated or discharged, as is undisputedly established in this case, the fact of that very act cannot itself constitute the basis for contributory negligence. Any other rule means that there is no responsibility on the part of the professional providing the health care once the patient is discharged, so long as the patient is not found to be devoid of any reason of any type, which is what the court's ruling was in this case in granting the contributory negligence and assumption of the risk instruction.
Mr. Carpenter, that's not the majority rule, is it? The majority rule is that there should be a subjective capacity-based instruction given rather than an objective instruction.
Your Honor, I'm not able to say what the majority is. I think you're right on what the majority is, but I think one of the cases that, and I don't remember which one, but indicated that the cases seem to be all over the place when you read them, and they all might stand for almost any proposition, but they all are driven by the facts. And yes, we agree that if that's not the majority rule, that should be the majority rule.
Did you propose an instruction on that sliding subjective
capacity? I did not propose an instruction on a sliding subjective scale because, Your Honor, as we made clear in our motion for a directed verdict, a motion for directed verdict on the issue of contributory negligence and assumption of the risk for the reasons that there is no evidence to support or to enable the jury to evaluate the effect of the mental illness itself on the issues of contributory negligence and assumption of the risk.
But you seem to be advocating that now, though.
Your Honor, it would be a better rule, but what I'm advocating is that when the act of suicide itself is asserted as the only basis for the finding of contributory negligence, that should not be permitted as a defense. And I think, if I can, Your Honor, the case I think that got the closest to telling us where we're at and what we're trying to deal with, because admittedly it's a very complex set of circumstances that we have, is the Supreme Court of Connecticut in Edwards versus Tardif. And the way that the Supreme Court of Connecticut analyzed it is as follows. It said, as a general rule, and this is a little bit different than what was discussed in the trial court, but I think it's the same thing. It says, as a general rule, negligence actions seeking damages for suicide of another will not lie because the act of suicide is considered a deliberate, intentional, and intervening act which precludes a finding that a given defendant, in fact, is responsible for the harm. So this is the rule. And really, when you boil it all down, this is the rule that the defendants are advocating, that there be no responsibility for suicide, unless, of course, the devoid of all reason standard somehow can be met.
Would we have to reverse our prior decision in that Fetzer case?
No, Your Honor, and I found it interesting that I think the Supreme Court back in 1925 recognized the same exact point that we're trying to make in this case, where the act itself that was to be prevented by the treatment is the basis for the claim of contributory negligence, that it won't lie. You know, the defendants quoted Fetzer at length, but they left out one of the instructions that the court gave. And I'll read from page 367. It says, the court further instructs the jury that if you believe and find from a preponderance of all of the evidence in this case that the defendant carelessly and negligently failed to give plaintiff such reasonable care and attention as his mental and physical condition required, insofar as his mental and physical condition were known to the said defendant, then and in that event, your verdict should be for the plaintiff and against the defendant. No contributory negligence if there's foreseeability. The Fetzer case said that there wasn't any evidence that the treating physician and the institutions knew that Mr. Fetzer was having delusions or whatever it was that caused him to go out the window after his appendicitis operation. And just to go back to the Tardif case.
Before you do, though.
Again, Your Honor.
Mr. Carpenter, before you do that, though, Fetzer did use what's been referred to this morning as kind of a sliding scale subjective standard. The court went on to say, "To excuse me, I'm thinking of the Minor case. No, that was the Minor. That was Fraser. I'm sorry. Fetzer didn't use. Did Fetzer use a subjective standard?
No. It talked on contributory negligence basically in the same terms that, like I'm saying, Tardif is, or that that is being urged, that unless you're devoid of all reason, there isn't any. You know, contributory negligence applies, and obviously a reasonable person doesn't commit suicide, so on discharge, there's no remedy.
Well, as I recall, Fetzer, they did use an instruction that the court instructs the jury that the degree of care and diligence required is measured both by the mental incapacity of the patient and the dangers which the surroundings indicate may befall that patient in view of any peculiar mental traits exhibited by the patient.
Okay,
and that indicates using a sliding scale.
Oh, okay, yeah, Your Honor, I guess I had overlooked or had forgotten that point. What the court went on to say is that suicide will not break the chain of causation if it was a foreseeable result of defendant's tortious act. The controlling factor in determining whether there may be a recovery for a failure to prevent a suicide is whether the defendants reasonably should have anticipated the danger that the deceased would attempt to harm himself. If the patient's act of suicide is a foreseeable result of the medical provider's breach of duty to treat the patient's act of suicide cannot be deemed a superseding cause of the patient's death that breaks the chain of causation between the medical provider and the patient, which absolves the medical provider from liability. And I think that that's the rule that makes sense when the only claim of contributory negligence is the act itself.
The doctrine of superseding cause is totally different than the doctrine of contributory negligence.
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's probably true, although in this case, it's the same thing. That's, I guess, exactly our point. The instruction of contributory negligence and assumption of the risk should not have been given. Public policy arguments that are being asserted by the defendants are without merit. There is absolutely no public policy, I submit to you, against finding liability on the part of a healthcare professional that improperly discharges and negligently discharges a patient in an unstable, under-medicated condition, and the jury so finds, based on professional expert opinion as is required, that was a problem, was a major contributing cause to the suicide. That's the case that we have here. And to get to my next point, the court doesn't have to reach all the things that we've been talking about, although I think if you think about it, it's like, is there any recourse at all or not? That's step number one. When the discharge is in an unstable condition, can you then say because you committed suicide, the doctor is not responsible? We go to the next point. We had the burden to establish by expert testimony both negligence and proximate cause of the injury. The defendants did not come forward and meet any burden relating to contributory negligence by introducing expert testimony to tell the jury that, Christy Dotson was, even if she became unstable, as we were concerned on discharge, she was able to control what happened at that time. Now, I really think that that's probably the most conclusive argument in this case, but I think the other one is equally as important. Where is the evidence? When they cite in their brief to the evidence, the only thing they cite you to when you go to the transcript and look at it is a couple of statements about that she went voluntarily from Sioux Falls to Yankton. What does that have to do with what the effect of this improper discharge that's been found and admitted had at the time of her suicide?
Mr. Carpenter, I'm a little bit concerned. I noticed when you were objecting to the instructions with contributory negligence, you referenced the hearing on the motion in limine.
Yes, Your Honor.
I can't find that in the record, that motion in limine hearing. Was there a hearing? Were these factors about?
Yes, Your Honor. There was. As a matter of fact, and when you try to apply logic to this set of circumstances, I think a telling thing is that the experienced counsel, Mr. Timpson and Mr. Sudbeck, when they answered our complaint, didn't allege contributory negligence and assumption of the risk. That's something that came over a year later. And we made a motion to strike those defenses. There was a hearing, you know, I can't tell you, it should be in the record. As a part of the record before the court. And in addition, there was a lengthy discussion in the pre-settlement of the instructions, you know, that of course isn't on the record. I'd like if I may then, if there aren't other questions, to go to jump ahead to this public policy argument. And as I already said, and I'm probably repeating myself, it's not against public policy for a physician who negligently discharges a patient, as determined by this jury, to be held responsible for the injuries caused thereby. And in addition, it's ironic, we have the state of South Dakota here arguing some type of public policy when its statute says you have to have this discharge form that you provide to this patient. It's for the protection of the patient. If the patient demands to get out, as is being asserted in this case, the doctor has to document that. What are the circumstances? How did this happen? None of that took place. The records don't show any instance to support that took place. But the public policy, getting back to the point, is clearly established by the by our South Dakota legislature and the rules adopted pursuant to the statute at HSC, that if there's a demand for discharge against advice, you have to take all of these steps. None of those steps were taken. A public policy that says once you're discharged, unless you're devoid of all reason, it doesn't matter whether you were properly treated or not, doesn't make sense.
I noticed that Judge Caldwell made that finding when she ruled that she would not give the she was going to give the contributory negligence instruction. What was there in the record prior to that time that dealt with that issue about her capabilities?
The only thing in the record, Your Honor, was our expert testimony stating that it's often, the patient is often unable to determine what's happening until it's out of control, and the expert testimony that this discharge in this condition was a substantial factor in her suicide. That's the expert testimony that was in the record. There was no expert testimony on the other side to say, hey, wait a minute, at that point in these circumstances, if we want to accept contributory negligence should apply at all, that she was capable of controlling the impulses.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you.
Mr. Timpson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Gary Timpson with Mary Ackerman, representing the defendants at Appalachia, South Dakota Human Services Center, and Dr. Hartley Allsgard. The matter has been thoroughly briefed, and I don't intend to dwell much on the factual aspects of the case. If this case is going to be decided on sympathy or emotion, which I know it won't be, I lose. I would have lost the trial court. It's a tragic case. You have the sudden and unseemly death of a vibrant young lady at her own hand, and it's a tragic situation. The state, nor Hartley Allsgard, try to deny or gainsay that. I think the important thing to remember here is when you clear away the foliage and the verbiage, the central issue is, in fact, that of contributory negligence or not. Maybe we ought to have a bit of a glossary here. It might be telling that a case that involves as many psychiatrists as it does lawyers is inevitably going to end up here. But Mr. Carpenter keeps talking about discharge and discharge and discharge. Christy Dodson was a voluntary admit. She went into Avera McKinnon at the outset. She there made a suicide attempt, but following that, rallied with family support, was apologetic, expressed that her, because of her devout Roman Catholic faith, she realized that at least in her perception, her actions were regarded as sinful. She said she would never do it again. She told her family that. She began forward thinking in terms of her planning and her care, and was thereafter very compliant with her care. I think the voluntary nature of her admission is a critical underpinning to understanding all aspects of this case. Dr. Stanley determined that she should have less than acute or short-term care and recommended to the family and Christy a transfer to HSC in Yankton, some 90 miles away. The fact that she got in her car with her husband and drove down there voluntarily, checked herself into that facility, I think is significant evidence of her interest in self-care and improvement, and certainly evidence of her willingness to be compliant with forward steps of care in her own treatment.
Mr. Timpson, those all bear on the issue of your client's negligence, which the jury found contrary to your client's, didn't they?
Well, they found that, Dr. Allsgard down there breached the standard of care. That's true, in the special questionnaire.
And that was the cause of her death?
They said it was a contributing cause. I don't think that was the cause of her death. I don't have the form in front of me. Was that a legal cause of plaintiff's damages? A legal cause of the injury. That's correct. But she's there, and there again, I have to say at the outset, you know, did HSC and Dr. Allsgard and other staff persons there comply in every particular with all the record-keeping requirements, staff meetings, group meetings, and those sorts of things in the way that their policies say? No. But is there any showing, and bear in mind, of course, the plaintiff has the burden of proof on all these issues. And if I can maybe just step ahead for a moment, you talked about the Fetzer case.
But that's not true with contributory negligence, though, is it?
No, that's true. That's true.
And aren't your, you know, your all your arguments seem to be going to a reasonable person standard for this patient. And is that an accurate standard? Shouldn't it be this sliding scale depending upon how severe their diagnosis is?
I don't know if I would adopt the term sliding scale. I think the cases in the majority, Justice Meyer Henry, say that, you know, this person, the test is whether or not he or she was in sufficient condition that they were not insane or demented, if they could appreciate, you know, the act of what they were doing. And certainly, I think all the evidence in this case would support the fact that Christy Dodson, at the time of discharge, was capable of expressing herself articulately and forming rational
Put on evidence to that effect?
No, but I'd like to address that. And the Fetzer case, which was quoted by Mr. Carpenter in his argument, first of all, we should note that that was a custodial, not a non-custodial case. The second thing is Fetzer, at 367, talks about, and I'm not going to quote at length, but that in all similar cases, the injuries complained of are directly due to the acts of the person suffering the injuries. That is contributory negligence. That is exactly the case here. Fetzer goes on to say, when somebody wants relief from that general rule, quote, the burden is clearly upon those seeking to be relieved from this rule to show such incapacity. They had Dr. May from San Francisco and Dr. Gutnick from Omaha testify live at trial or by deposition. And so the burden was on them to say no. At the time of discharge, Christy didn't have this capacity. She was sufficiently diminished. So the burden of proving contributory negligence, i.e., that the death was at Christy's hand, was ours. And I think that's uncontroverted.
But isn't that an issue that the jury should have been allowed to make, and that they should have been instructed, as they were in Fetzer, to make that sliding judgment based upon her capacity?
Well, I think they were instructed on the standard of care, and as to the reasonable
person. They were told only a reasonable person. They weren't told to consider her capacity.
That's true, Judge Rush. But according to that, the burden to show that she was other than a reasonable person, i.e., had some level of diminishment or impairment of capacity, is on the plaintiff. They had two experts from around the country, and they didn't offer that evidence. Nobody said Christy was incapable of forming this intent, or Christy was incapable, or had a diminished capacity to evaluate her actions and those consequences, and it was their burden to have done so. They didn't do so. She was down there as a voluntary admin. The statute says, and it's undisputed, that there was a form that's to be completed that was not timely completed. All right? And I'll get to that in a minute. But she has to be released unless there are involuntary commitment proceedings initiated against her. Doctors Allsgard and Grove testified that they did not feel that the evidence was sufficient, that they would have been justified in initiating involuntary commitment proceedings against her at that point. And the plaintiff's two experts never opined that, hey, when she wanted to go, there should have been involuntary commitment proceedings initiated against her. They testified, yeah, you have this form and it's in their policy, therefore the failure to follow it fails to meet the standard of care.
Let me ask you the same thing I asked Mr. Carpenter. Supposedly there was a hearing on a motion in limine, at which apparently these issues would have all been discussed. Where is the record of that in our record here?
That, Your Honor, I can't tell you. I think I do remember that there was a hearing on that because, as Mr. Carpenter said, both the co-defendant, who's not a party here, and ourselves moved to amend our answers to assert that defense, and there was an objection to that, and the matter was heard. I'm going to be very candid. Can I remember whether there was a telephonic hearing or whether Mr. Carpenter was in Sioux Falls and we heard it in chambers? I don't have that recollection presently. As maybe an adjunct to that comment, Mr. Carpenter says, well, gee, the defendants didn't even assert this defense till after a year. Well, the realities of litigation are that a plaintiff gets a case, can study it, consult his experts, research the law, do that sort of thing for, as in this case, about a year before filing the complaint. then the defendant, of course, has to answer. It's not unusual that after filing an initial response of pleading, that research and further discovery compels one to the conclusion that there might be other defenses available that weren't so readily apparent when the initial response of pleading was filed. So I think that's wholly immaterial to the issue. He talked about the Connecticut case. And I think also that case is immaterial here in that, well, I'll get back to that. I can't find it among my notes here. But so this lady is here on a voluntary admit, and she wants to leave. There's no statutory authority to hold her, no medical or ethical way to hold her, absent the institution of involuntary commitment proceedings, which there is no expert testimony contradicting that of the defense that the requisite standards to have done that weren't there. Now, when you have a non-custodial setting, the situation is unique. Is there a showing that had she stayed at HSC another 7, 15, 30, or whatever days, that this wouldn't have happened? No. Is there a showing that had this form been completed in a timely way, that she would not have taken the actions taken? No. If she had been discharged under these circumstances and committed suicide 10, 30, or 60 days later, would there still be liability? I think what the plaintiff is almost urging is kind of a bright line test that says you have to keep somebody a minimum of such time to absolve yourself of liability, or failing that, if there's a discharge, if you want to call it against medical advice.
But that's not exactly true, is it? Isn't there a foreseeability test even with this? Even if it's non-custodial, it's still got to go on foreseeability.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there again,
it's a bright line test. It's whether or not it's foreseeable when they're discharged.
And there was expert testimony from the defendants that, you know, I don't know if there's ever an element where somebody seeks mental health treatment where you can say that it is not foreseeable. Is there a likelihood, or is there a practicality that suicide is a realistic thing, or that the person is deemed reasonably safe? Allsgard knew that she had voluntarily come from Avera down to HSC. She was compliant with her care. She had progressed after her April 1 suicide attempt, both at Avera and at HSC. She's attended to her hygiene, her nutrition. She was exercising. She was talking about family plans upon discharge, expressed to staff her willingness and eagerness to get better. And they had, and the record shows, it's unusual. A lot of times there's a gap between release and follow-up care just due to the availability of services. And they were especially encouraged that the very next day after her release, at her own request, that she was going to be seen at Capital City Mental Health Services here in Pierre for treatment. She was willing and able to do that. The other thing is, the record is replete with evidence that the stressors that brought her to this position were her feelings of inadequacy as a wife, difficulty with physical intimacy, some issues she had with her parents' divorce, and family issues. When she was leaving, she expressed the fact that she wanted to be left alone, have some time alone, but she was immediately taken to an extended family dinner, went home, and there's just no way of knowing. It's real speculation. Did those stressors precipitate something in her that was dormant at the time of her request for release? There's nothing.
But the jury found those issues against, contrary to your client.
Well, they found the one issue, that Dr. Allsgard, but they also found that her own actions contributed in a way more than slight to the result, thus precluding recovery. And I think
the jury was never instructed that they were supposed to look at her mental capacity, were they?
Well, they were instructed that they were to look at a reasonable person, and as Fetzer says, if she was other than reasonable, if there was a diminishment of that capacity, the burden was on the plaintiff to make that demonstration. They had two expert witnesses there, and they never did that. There's no evidence that had that instruction been different, the jury would have found anything different, because there was no evidence in the record to show that as far as the capacity to form the intent and design, that she was in any way diminished. She had these bipolar problems, and she'd had some previous somatic issues where she had this endometriosis and physical manifestations, which were now behind her. But if let's assume that we had this sliding scale instruction. You start with a reasonable person here and a total incapacity at the other end. There's no evidence that would move them off the reasonable person anyway. And according to Fetzer, it's the plaintiff's burden to put that in the record. If her capacity, as it relates to her ability to appreciate the effects of her design and a plan and accomplishment of suicide, are less than, quote, a reasonable person, it's their burden. They had two psychiatrists from San Francisco and Omaha who could have testified to that.
You don't think that the evidence before the court that she was suffering from bipolar disease, that this in many cases results in suicide, is sufficient to justify the sliding scale instruction?
Well, frankly, you know, it's not whether I think so, it's whether the jury thinks so, and I don't know. We know from the expert testimony that a lot of bipolar people do commit suicide. We also know that a great many of them live out their lives without any self-destructive behavior. If Christie's condition was such that she lacked the capacity to do that and it was truly foreseeable that she might do it, the burden is on the plaintiff to say, yes, this is her condition. We have experts.
But doesn't the jury still need to be instructed of that, that they can take that into consideration? And with this particular reasonable person standard, they weren't able to take that into consideration.
Well, in the abstract, I guess that's true, but there was nothing for them to consider. It had there been testimony that this, and I can't quantify it for sake of argument, that she was at 75% or whatever this sliding scale toward capacity is. Had there been that testimony, and Judge Caldwell says, I don't care, we're going to go the 100% reasonable person standard, and that's it. That's the standard that you as the jurors must apply, contrary to the evidence that you've heard, or in disregard of the evidence you heard, very likely you might argue that there was error here. But where the only standard is reasonable, and there's nothing that says, or from which the jury could logically infer she was at less than that, because it requires expert testimony, I think when you consider the instructions as a whole, no, I don't think there was error, and I don't think the jury was misled.
Did this subject come up in final argument in front of the jury?
You mean as to the level of capacity?
Right.
Without reference to the transcript, I can't honestly recall it. I don't recall that it did, Mr. Chief Justice, but the record would have to be the transcript.
All the jury had, it had no final argument, it had no instruction on this other than the reasonable person, and it had the two experts of the plaintiffs, which you say is faulty because it doesn't support their claim.
I'm not saying it's faulty. I'm saying it's deficient or it's lacking. It doesn't address this element.
All right.
Yeah.
Mr. Timpson, tell me this. I was kind of struck by the fact that the assumption of the risk instruction was tempered a little bit in this case, but the contributory negligence was not. Do you recall how that happened?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question.
The assumption of the risk instruction. There was a qualification, I can't remember exactly the wording of it right now, but to accommodate for the mental illness, it almost suggested that defense might not apply in this case. And a similar tempering of the contributory negligence instruction was not made. And I was just surprised that there had been a change to the assumption of the risk instruction, but not contributory negligence.
Well, I don't recall the specifics on the settlement of those instructions, but there again, I'm glad you picked up on that point because I was going to address it. As this court has said numerous times, you know, you have to look at the instructions as a whole body and whether or not they achieve. So this tempering effect, if you will, was part of the instructions the jury heard. But I think that's important, but I think argument might have been important, but I think the critical thing is the jury. If there was to be evidence of an application of less than a reasonable person, it's incumbent upon the plaintiff to produce it, and they didn't. And lacking any evidence of diminishment or lack of capacity, the reasonable standard obtains. So contributory negligence ought to be given. This young lady tragically and unfortunately died because she made the plan and effected the design to take her own life. There is no evidence beyond mere speculation that had she stayed at HSC longer, had a form been completed, had her medications been different, that the result would have been different in terms of result or time. So the question is, how much of that do you apportion to these administrative failures, which the experts said departed from the standard of care on the part of Dr. Alsgaard, or on the part of the young lady who did the actual physical act and formed the actual intent to take her own life. And the jury found that her actions were more than slight. And they're not, and the current and the majority of authority, your clerks can check my figures here. I think the cases that uphold the giving of this type of an instruction in a non-custodial situation are nine, and I think Mr. Carpenter cited five cases, most of which are older. So I think the greater and more current trend of judicial thought is to say, yes, the psychiatric profession and the legal profession are realizing that the less intrusive, the less restrictive modes of treatment are more acceptable and more productive. And in a non-custodial situation, unless there is, you know, pretty substantial evidence that this person lacks the capacity for self-preservation or is evidencing an immediate threat to him or herself, that this instruction ought to be given.
But Mr. Timpson, even the New York case, which you cite in your brief and rely on, says, quote, the standard of care of which mental patient must be exercised is based on his or her capacity.
Yeah.
And that's one of the cases in your that you cite as a support for your proposition here.
Right. Justice Sinner, and I'm not trying to dodge that bullet. What I'm trying to say is, as Fetzer said, yes, if it becomes an issue, if somebody says, no, she didn't, then to assert that affirmative didn't meet that standard, then I think the defense has to counter that with expert testimony and say, yes, she did. But where the record is totally silent on the point, there is no starting point or focal point other than reasonable person. I see my time has expired, and I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Timpson. Mr. Carpenter, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Well, Mr. Carpenter, while you're coming up to the podium, maybe you could address this point that Mr. Timpson made several times, that there was no testimony, expert testimony, that that this young lady had any diminished capacity.
Your Honor, I can, and I hope I didn't lose my place, but I've got the statement that the plaintiff did not produce any evidence to say that she should not have been discharged is refuted. There's a number of places where we talk about the diminished capacity due to the instability of the patient and the inability to recognize what's happening, the effect of bipolar disorder. But if you go to page 99 of volume 3 of the trial transcript to 99 and 100, you'll see where Dr. Gutnick is explaining his basis for saying that the discharge was a substantial factor and cause of the suicide. And in that, he goes through what should have been done and then says, and failing the ability to convince her to voluntarily continue to stay, and failing that, I think there was adequate evidence to commit her. That's exactly contrary to what Mr. Timpson has just told you, that we submitted no testimony to that effect. I think that, I know I'm jumping around, I'm trying to hurry, but Justice Meyer Henry has her finger right on the point of our case. That's the foreseeability. When there is foreseeability that the negligent discharge could lead to a suicide in a condition that's recognized and a patient that had just committed suicide, then under Restatement Second, 449, that's been adopted by this South Dakota Supreme Court, the happening of the very event, the likelihood of which makes the actor's conduct negligent and so subjects the actor to liability, cannot relieve him from liability. That's comment B, Restatement of Torts Section Second, Section 449. That's the law of this state. Now, we can go back and forth on Fetzer. I'm not aware, and we talk about all these cases, there are no cases that say that it's the duty of the plaintiff to prove contributory negligence. And the court in Fetzer, and I just go back, and I know I'm repeating myself a little bit, but it also said, and going back to the foreseeability, it said specifically, the court instructs the jury that if you believe and find from a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant carelessly and negligently failed to give plaintiff such reasonable care and attention as to his mental and physical condition required, and then this is the key point, foreseeability, insofar as his mental and physical condition were known to said defendant, then, and in that event, your verdict should be for the plaintiff. That's what the South Dakota Supreme Court said. If this case controls, this case says that where there's a finding of negligence and foreseeability, the verdict should be for the plaintiff. If the voluntary admit is so important to this case, then I would submit to the court, why then didn't HSC see it important to follow its own statutorily required procedures stated right in that it's for the protection, to protect the rights of the patient, to provide adequate documentation of the request for release. The physician will document the findings in the patient's chart. If the voluntary aspect of the was so important, then why wasn't the discharge policies and procedures, which say right on to provide upon voluntary patient's request the correct form to request release from SDHSC in writing pursuant to the laws of South Dakota, referring, of course, to the statute that we mentioned. We go back, unless there are other questions, I think what we would say, respectfully submit, is that there's a finding of negligence, and the negligence is clear. I mean, it's just all over the place in this particular case. And if you believe Dr. Alsgaard, that in fact he thought she should stay there and she shouldn't get out, then how can we reconcile the fact that he didn't tell the family, he didn't provide the form, he didn't give the opportunity, as our experts indicated, to talk her into staying longer, and he didn't, as our expert testified, pursue the involuntary commitment that should have taken place. With that, we ask that the court reverse, and that the reversal be with a direction to be retried on damages only. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.